1, 2, 3.
Welcome to Three Song Stories. You know how sometimes you'll hear a song and it will automatically just take you back to a time in your life? On this show, we use those connections to bring out the storyteller and our guests. Thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. Our guest this week is Kyone Wolfe. Kyone is the host of Audacious on Connecticut Public Radio. It features conversations with people who have uncommon or misunderstood experiences, conditions, or professions. Audacious is a 3-time Gracie Award winner. The Gracie Awards recognize exemplary programming created by women, for women, and about women in all facets of media and entertainment. Kyone is a recipient of the Advocates Champions of Pride 2021 as a, quote, unsung hero who's making inroads for LGBTQ plus people in their fields of work and in their communities every day, despite the risks or challenges. She's also the host of Other People's Poems, an event during which people share one poem they love, but that they didn't write, and those who have their poems memorized get a loofah. Kyone used to produce and host a live storytelling event at the Mark Twain House and Museum in Hartford called The Mouth Off, and a live advice show at CT Improv's underground comedy theater called Asking for a Friend with Kyone Wolfe. She's also a certified judge with the International Chili Society, and her bio says a proud homeowner in Hartford's Asylum Hill neighborhood where she cares deeply and enthusiastically for her pollinator and veggie gardens, 4 chickens, Russian honeybees, her cat named Whiskey, and her also Russian dog named Gray. Hey there, Kyone. How are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
I am wonderful as well. Happy Friday.
Thanks. You too.
Are you named after snow or small dogs or neither?
Neither. It was a name that I gave myself. I was originally born named after my grandma, who everybody agreed was like the best. Her name was Marie, Julia, Gladys. But growing up, I knew that as much as everybody loved her and she died before I was born, I knew growing up that that wasn't my name and that it wasn't appropriate for me to be named after somebody else because I was a special freaking snowflake. But I have 3 big brothers, and the Gladys family is very popular in the town where I grew up. And so I wasn't going to change my name till I graduated high school. And Kyone came from a Greek martyr named Kyonia. And I'm not even sure if that's how it's pronounced. I just totally made it up. My mom made an agreement with me that me as a non-believer at the time in God or religion, she was a CCD teacher, and she said, listen, get confirmed in the Catholic Church, and you can decide whether you keep going to church or not. And as a non-believer, I'm like, well, this is a fantastic deal. I will absolutely get confirmed, no problem. And so in the big book of saints and martyrs, everybody else was choosing like Rebecca and Lee and Anne and names that I thought were too pedestrian for a special snowflake like myself. And then I found Kyonia, Agape, and Irene were these 3 sisters who were martyred. And I was like, well, that's a cool name. I'll take it. And then years later, when I graduated high school, it was time for me to change my name. I took my stepfather's last name, which was Wolf. I met him when I was 11, and he was a big influence on my life. And then when it came to the first name, it was either going to be Julia, my middle name that I was born with. But I thought there were a lot of Julia Wolfs in the world, and I didn't want to be able to get away with anything. So I decided Kyonia sounded a little whiny, and I took the Ia off and left it at Kyone and legally changed it. And so it's been a long time now.
What a great answer.
Well, somebody who took biblical Greek in high school, because I'm a special friggin' snowflake. you are kind of named after snow then.
Well, tell me more. I mean, I know about Kyone. Kyonophile is a lover of snow.
It's the Greek word, Kyonia.
Yeah. It's snow.
It's snow.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that I am saying my name correctly?
Well, I mean, Richard, yes.
I is like iota, so Kyonia. Yeah, Kyonia.
Oh my.
Maybe they could say like Kyonia, depending on.
Oh,
like,
as opposed to the own accent. Got it.
Yeah, but you don't have an ia, so Kyone.
That's wild. My whole life, I just figured I made it up, and I figured I'm probably saying it wrong, but
you
words are all made up. Wow, this has been, we can stop the interview now. I'm all set. My mind is freaking blown.
Did you though know that the word C-H-I-O-N refers to what are referred to as sidewalk dogs that are a cross between a chihuahua and a papillion?
I have heard that, yes, from all the memes that people send me when they see that dog. Yep.
Okay, let's get on the actual train of three song stories here now. Where did you grow up, Kyone, and how would you characterize the musical background of your childhood growing up?
I grew up in Farmington, Connecticut, and the first thing that pops in my head is Led Zeppelin, Rolling Stones, Van Morrison, Brown Eyed Girl, and Into the Mystic. Oof. But that I just remember specifically my dad playing these, especially Led Zeppelin, playing Zeppelin on Sunday mornings, and I wake up and I smell the bacon and eggs that he's making and this loud music just rumbling through the house. It was really a wonderful gift to get to grow up with that kind of music.
Playing it on vinyl, on CDs? I'm trying to figure out the time frame.
You know, I was born in 1980, and so there was vinyl in the house and there was a record player, but it was probably cassette and then CDs.
Did your mom have similar musical tastes?
You know, I have no memory. I have a lot of memories of my mom, but musically, no. I don't think she was as much of an enthusiastic contributor as my dad was.
What about brothers or sisters?
Oh, for sure. I have three big brothers, and my big brother Chris, I would say, was a major influence in my life in many ways. But he introduced me to Weird Al and Dr. Demento and Emo Phillips. Stone Roses was thanks to my big brother Chris. So I'd say he had a big one.
Do you have any musical memories stemming from your grandparents by chance?
Not at all. I barely knew them.
So what was the first band or musician that really got your attention as a young individual that you didn't come to because of your, you know, older brother or your dad?
Oof. Well, the first CD I ever bought was Wilson Phillips.
Huh.
And it was probably through one of those Columbia House.
I just had a chill go down my spine.
Yeah, tell me about it. It was probably one of those like Columbia House buy 10 for a penny and then get billed hundreds of dollars later deals. You remember those?
Oh, of course. Did you follow through on the contract?
Oh, as a 11-year-old? I'm sure I did. Yes, very thorough with my contract reading. But I also really loved Pearl Jam. 10 is a really important record for me. I was, like I said, I was born in 1980, which means that when I turned into a moody teenager, it aligned so perfectly with Pearl Jam and Smashing Pumpkins and Nirvana, Nine Inch Nails, Pretty Hate Machine. So moody. I was so lucky to get such great artists to be upset with.
So was the Wilson Phillips pre-moody then?
It was slightly pre-moody. I think it was the gateway into the tortured teenager.
I can
era.
See how Wilson Phillips might tee up tortured teenager.
Sure. Anything's possible. They're really priming the emotions, I think.
When was the last time you listened to Wilson Phillips? Didn't know you were going to be talking about Wilson Phillips so much.
honestly, who knows that they're going to be talking or thinking this much about Wilson Phillips? You know, I heard Hold On in some sort of mix when I was listening to Tidal. You know, you just sort of let it shuffle and it tries to guess what you want. And Hold On came and I was like, yeah, this, as the kids say, slaps.
Had a lot of soul in a non-soulful kind of way.
Hey, it worked. It worked for the time being, right?
Were instruments being played around you and or did you play any yourself?
Oh, yeah. All three of my big brothers played the guitar. And I thought that was so cool because if you learn to play the guitar, that means you could be like obviously before the internet, a radio. And you could like, if you learn to play the guitar, you could play any song you wanted. And so if I want to hear Led Zeppelin, I could just start playing it. But it turns out the guitar is kind of hard. But it was thanks to my big brothers very patiently teaching my very soft fingertips how to figure that out. And then I discovered Ani DiFranco, as many people did in the 90s, and started learning her songs. And the internet happened, and I was able to look up tabs and chords and figure out how to play. And she had all these different tunings instead of standard, which I didn't know was legal. But it turns out you can absolutely mess around with the tuning. And so it was thanks to Ani DiFranco that I started learning how to play the guitar myself.
Do you still play today?
I am looking at my Gibson Hummingbird that is on the wall.
Yes.
Dusty with old strings and a capo sitting lonely at the top. It's funny because I actually wrote two albums in my moody later teen years and early 20s. But like all the songs were written when I was sad or frustrated or confused. And so every time I would play the songs, I would keep feeling that way. And I wondered why I wasn't getting over this breakup or this heartache. And I realized if I just put the thing down and I stopped singing these songs, I might be able to feel better. And that's exactly what happened. And so even though later in my life I had plenty of things to be sad and upset and frustrated and confused about, I just never picked it up again. And now I'm just gazing upon its glory.
You're going to go down and see Ani DiFranco in Hadestown?
I already did. I just did last weekend. I am very fortunate to be good friends with her cousin Roxana, and so I've gotten to hang out with Ani a couple times, and she was wonderful. I absolutely highly not only do I suggest seeing Ani in Hadestown in general, but also to know that there's not one voice that's going to be on Broadway, and to hear Ani DiFranco in this context is really kind of eye-opening for me, and I think for a lot of people to think, oh, it's not just one style of voice that's going to be on these stages. And to see what she's done with her career makes, I think, it encourages people to look at what they're doing and think even bigger.
That's so cool. I introduced my daughter to Ani DiFranco via Little Plastic Castles. When she was 12, we drove over to the other coast to see Willy Wonka in the theater, and it really got her attention. And now she's a freshman in college in Philly studying musical theater. And so when she found out that Ani DiFranco was doing Hadestown, which is like her second favorite show, her head exploded.
Outstanding. It's funny. Having Ani as an influence as a younger person is so powerful, I think. Like, you can't shake these songs. And on that album, there's that song Gravel, which I really, really loved. And when Ani lives in New Orleans, and her cousin Roxana invited me to hang out with her and Ani for Roxana's 55th birthday last year. And we pulled up to Ani's house, and Ani has, and I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, I'm in a cab pulling up to Ani DiFranco's house. Like, if only my, 15-year-old self could see me now. And as we pull up, I see that her driveway is made out of gravel. And so you bet I picked up a single piece of gravel and put it in my pocket. And now that piece of gravel is sitting on my kitchen counter, reminding me that anything could happen, I guess.
That is so cool. When was the first time you saw music performed live?
It was 1988, I believe. So I was probably 8. It was the Monkees and the Beach Boys at Lake Compounds, which is an amusement park here in Bristol, Connecticut. And I remember, so I love the Monkees very much. Big fan of Mickey Dolenz. He's my man. And I remember hearing them, and I turned to my big brother, Chris, and I said, they don't sound the same like on the tape. And Chris said, that's the point. Oh, right. Okay. Got it. It was awesome.
Yeah, real quick coincidence. My first concert was also in that same year when the Monkees did their reunion tour, because they had gotten big because of MTV doing all the syndication.
Wow.
We drove up to the county north of us, Charlotte County, to the fair, and saw the Monkees and Herman's Hermits.
I'm not familiar with Herman's Hermits. Will you fill me in?
Oh, I'm not either, really. They're just one of those bands from back then. I don't know. All I know is that I saw the Monkees probably on the same tour that you did.
Whoa. Who's your favorite monkey?
Mickey.
Yes.
We went because my sister fell in love with Davy, but I was a Mickey guy. Who couldn't be a Mickey guy?
I'm with you. Although it's funny you mentioned Davy. I sported a haircut, a Davy Jones haircut. And like when I went to the hairstylist, that was exactly what I requested. So that fills in some blanks about me, too.
Okay. Well, let's do your first song, Kion. What do you want to do? You want to tell a story or you want to listen to it?
Oof. Okay. I think everybody knows this song, so we don't have to play it first.
Okay. So you're going to tell the story?
All right. So the song is You Can't Always Get What You Want by the Rolling Stones. I am 5 years old in the mid-80s. I'm sitting at the dinner table, or at least I think I am in this memory. And I recognize that memories are wonky. So I'm so glad to have this opportunity to talk about this memory. And in my memory, it's time for dessert. I love mint chocolate chip ice cream, the Breyers kind that's white, because when you drizzle maraschino cherry juice on it, it makes it pink. And I love pink. So I have my first bowl of ice cream, and then I want a second bowl, like any decent child would. And I am denied the second bowl of ice cream, and so I break into tears. And in my memory, my three big brothers start singing, "You can't always get what you want," which of course hurts and infuriates me, and I just burst into tears even more. And as I was getting ready to have this conversation with you, because I knew we'd be talking about this song, I asked my brothers and my mom, like, what do you remember? Because we still joke about this song. Everybody remembers this song with me. And I said, what do you remember about it? And my brother Michael says that he recalls that I wanted, that we were in the car. So we were not at a dinner table. We were in the car, and I wanted to sit in the middle seat, and then I wanted to sit in the window seat, and then I kept changing my mind about where I wanted to sit, and my mom, like as if the tape were queued up in the tape deck of the car, just pressed it, and "You Can't Always Get What You Want" started playing. And I started wailing again, and it was incredibly painful. And then I asked my mother what she remembers, and she says she doesn't remember the details exactly, but she puts a nice little button on it and says that the most important thing is the second line of that song, which is, "If you try sometimes, you just might find you get what you need."
Was there ice cream in either of their recollections?
No, that was all mine. That was all mine.
Wow, memory's funny. Well, let's listen to it. Imagining you apparently in your folks' car. This is song number one for our guest today, Kyone Wolf. She's host of the show Audacious on Connecticut Public Radio. This is "You Can't Always Get What You Want" by the Rolling Stones from their album Let It Bleed, released in 1969. This is Three Song Stories. So prior to preparing for this show and talking to your mom and your brother, that it was only recently then that you realized there wasn't an ice cream element in your memory?
That's right. Yeah. I hadn't really had any opportunity or reason to ask him about this besides, you know, the wink and nod. Anytime we would hear it, we would know it was about, we would know that song was about me and that memory of them mocking my pain. But no, I didn't know about the difference in memory either.
Being the public radio journalist that you are, you have some tape for us of your mom and your brother. Richard, which should we play first, Kyone?
Yeah, let's play Michael, my big brother, who, by the way, was in... I just love showing this off because it's so cool. Michael was in Mad Men.
Wow!
Yep.
Who?
His character's name was Paul Kinsey. He had a beard and a pipe. He was...
Oh, my God! That's your brother? Yeah,
that's my brother, Michael Gladys.
He's like my favorite character in Mad Men.
Come on now! That makes me so happy.
I just recently rewatched it.
Ah, how cool. And recently he was in the Hulu series with Mandy Patinkin, Death and Other Details, and it was his death that was initially the one they had to solve.
Well, I will have to watch that next because I love Mandy Patinkin. That's so cool. Anyway, let's listen to Richard play it.
My memory of us singing "You Can't Always Get What You Want" by the Rolling Stones at my little sister takes place in the car. There were four of us kids, so one of us would sit up front with mom, and the other three would have to sit across the bench seat in the back. And in this instance, I believe I was sitting up front, and Kyone was screaming and crying that she wanted to be in the middle of the seat. So my mom put her in the middle seat, and Chris and Paul were on the windows, and we got underway. And Kyone started screaming and crying that she wanted a window seat. And in my memory, my mom just pops the tape into the car stereo and presses play as if the song were already queued up. And the Rolling Stones, "You Can't Always Get What You Want," comes on. And with the chorus, we all sang it at my little sister at the top of our lungs while she cried. This is how I think everyone should learn life lessons as a child. I plan on using this on my daughter, baby. Love you, sis.
Love you, Michael.
That is so great. Let's see. Play mom next, Richard.
I remember there being a connection. I do not remember the incident of the car and which window and things like that. Because to me, the most meaningful part of that song is not always can't always get what you want. But after that, but if you try sometime, you just might find you get what you
get
need.
What you need.
Yeah.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but basically for the longest time, whenever you heard that song, you thought of ice cream, or at least you thought there was a white Breyers mint chocolate chip ice cream element to it. You know, you've mentioned how memory's a fickle thing. Does that mean from now on you'll have to like remember different when you hear that song?
Oh, gosh.
Or can you undo? I mean, how does that work?
Well, I mean, what's even right? Because did my brother make up that memory? Did I?
Right.
Well, and what would I mean, the end game is still my beloved family mocking my pain. So as long as that's consistent, I don't think it matters where it was. And we can agree on that.
We don't always get a chance for memories to be reversed this way. But does eating that ice cream with the maraschino cherries make you think of the song?
Well, it's funny because I'm realizing that in the song, red keeps coming. Like, we decided we would have a soda, my favorite flavor, cherry red. I saw her today at the reception. In her glass was a bleeding man. We could tell by her blood-stained hands. Red is a part of this song. So for all I know, I made up everything because subtly the redness of the song got into the pinkness of the ice cream. Listen, I don't know, man. I have no idea. But I still love the ice cream.
Crisis here. Sorry.
Yeah, we did. Yeah,
unfolding live.
This is going to be a strange aside, but, you know, I don't know if you have watched very many, president and former president, I guess, Donald Trump rallies, but you know, that's how he ends his rallies with that song.
I did not.
All the way back to like when he was running. Like I've always,
no, it's somehow
so weird. It's
a weird
so
choice
weird.
Of a song.
Oh, I know.
I know. It's hurting my brain. Little bit, like he often does. So that's great to know. Thanks for giving me another painful memory around
now
the song.
Now you will forever associate Donald Trump with Breyers ice cream.
Wow. Hey, listen, I don't know what I signed up for here, but let's move on.
Okay. Where did you fit into the scene in high school? What was your jam in high school?
Oh, the music scene or like any scene?
Just the scene. Yeah, you know.
Oh,
what
sure.
What were you in high school?
Well, so I was just weird enough to be friends with everybody. Like I got, for whatever it's worth, I was elected homecoming princess, not because I was, you know, like a popular girl, but I think it's because I was friends with everybody. I really was drawn to people who were outcast and different and lonely. And I was really drawn to the popular girls who were troublesome and fascinating. And also, all of them were just so utterly human. And that's just, so I fit in really, really well. And I had a lot of big emotions and also a drive to share those feelings. And thankfully this was before the internet or else all of my feelings would have been still available for y'all to look up. But yeah, I grew up in Farmington, Connecticut, and it was a nice place to be. And I also came out of the closet as a gay person in the 90s there and was treated with, for the most part, with some little weird exceptions that turned into good stories, I was treated pretty well. So, yeah, it was a happy, happy teendom amongst the angst.
You an artsy kid? You a sportsy kid? Some combination? Were you, you know, what were your pursuits?
Yeah, sure. I played soccer. I was a savage goalie, completely feared and very powerful. I was really good. I loved goalie. And I was also in band. I started with a cello and then to clarinet and then tuba. That was a family tradition. Two of my three big brothers played tuba. And I didn't read music very well, so it was good to be able to sit next to them to sort of watch and listen to what they were doing instead of actually learning how to read music. And all theater, singing, all the good stuff.
What shows were you in, if any, that you can remember?
I don't remember the names of any of them. I remember I remember there was Little Foxes, Antigone, But those I was not in, so totally irrelevant. But my brother was, because of course my brother, the actor, was definitely much more active. But yeah, bit little bit roles. There was one, there was one play, and I'm forgetting the name of it, but I had to kiss a boy in it, and the boy I now know was also gay, and so we couldn't bring ourselves to do it. We just couldn't do it, and so now whenever I see him, his name is Luke. Just saw him at our 20th high school reunion, and it, I was flooded with memories of how we just couldn't bring ourselves to kiss each other for this play because we were both so very gay and clearly not committed enough to the characters in high school.
That's why you didn't go on to become an actor.
That's right.
Seems like a lot of your grown-up life, you know, somehow brushes up against storytelling. Was that part of you as a high school student, or did that come later?
I think that was a result of having a great storytelling mom. My mom is just super expressive and knows how to tell, knows what details to cut out of a story. Because, you know, when you tell a story, you can tell many versions of it. And sometimes you include stuff that doesn't really make a difference to what you're trying to get across. My mom was just a really great storyteller, and I think I inherited it from her.
What did you have your mindset on during high school as something you might pursue later, you know, college and, you know, in life? Or did you have a plan that early?
I had no idea. When I went to UConn, I majored in changing majors. I was not good at school. I almost didn't graduate high school, and I dropped out of UConn. And then I went into cell phone sales for 10 years in a mall. And I remember feeling like I was good at it, and I was learning a lot about how to talk to people and how to be a good customer service agent and an honest salesperson. But I knew that was not my destiny. But it's funny because looking back now, I used to have little radio shows with my big brother, Paul. We would pretend we were people we were interviewing, you know, we were famous sports people or famous actors, and we would just swap interview roles. And I still have the tape, and it's wild to think like, oh yeah, I was a little public radio host back when I was a kid. And I think that is telling. Like when you look back at when you were 6, 7, 8, like what kind of things lit you up? What kind of things really drove you? And I think sometimes that is a big clue as to what you'd be really good at later in life.
Was public radio part of your family's sort of ethos all the way through?
Absolutely. Grew up listening to NPR around the dinner table. You know what I heard on NPR today? In the car when they weren't playing, you can't always get what you want to terrorize me. Yeah, it was NPR, NPR, NPR all the time.
How does one make a pivot from selling cell phones in the mall to hosting a show on Connecticut Public Radio?
I was driving around one day listening to NPR, and Bill Henry was the voice of our station at the time, and he said that they needed people to answer phones for the fun drive. And I was 27 or so at the time, and I'd never volunteered for anything in my life, shamefully. And I thought, oh, well, this is, and it was a self-serving thought, this will be cool. What if I answer phones for the fun drive? Maybe I'll get to meet some of the voices that I have grown up listening to. That would be really cool. So my best friend, Jonathan, and I went to the station, and we were in a room full of very nice older ladies with white hair. And at the time, my hair was locked, and I have a bunch of tattoos, and Jonathan has super curly hair, a bunch of tattoos. So we really stood out. And John Dankosky, who at the time was the news director and the host of our morning show, Where We Live, and the creator of it, he pops his head into the room where we're answering the phones, and he says, hey, just want to say thank you, really appreciate you volunteering. And as soon as he spoke, I knew who he was, and I just started peppering him with questions like, how did you get into this job? How did you start this program? How do you come up with your ideas for your shows? How do you come up with all the questions? Just like one after another. And then he answered them. And the answer is, for the most part, producers. It's the producers. Gave me a tour of the newsroom. And I was like, I felt like a toddler at NASA and just totally elated and impressed, and peppered him with more questions. And then he said, you know, we just started an internship program. Maybe you'd be interested. And yes, and it was thankfully before you had to be in college, where now that's a part of it. It was okay to be a cell phone salesperson and doing this internship. So my boss let me do closing shifts, and I started doing morning shifts at the station. And then there's a much longer story, but many years later, now here I am.
We won't go into the details, but you and I have very parallel paths into public radio, Kyan.
Yeah. Tell me about it.
Oh, no, I'll tell you later. We don't need to go through it now, but I did, you know, I took me 16 years to get my bachelor's degree, and I stumbled into public radio as an intern at the age of 30.
Yes. Yes. I was 27 or something like that. Yes.
Okay. Let's go ahead and do your second song. Then we'll get into the cool stuff that you do besides, you know, public radio and beyond. How do you want to handle this second song?
Let's play the song first.
Okay. This is Kyan Wolf's second song here on Three Song Stories. This is Silent All These Years by Tori Amos from her 1992 album Little Earthquakes.
I am 14 years old. It's 1994. And this is definitely not the first time I've heard this song. It is like the 1,000th time I've heard this song. My first love, Chris, had played me Little Earthquakes by Tori Amos. And we had turned we turned the whole album into like a secret language. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, where you share an album with someone really special and it's like the way you speak, you reference the lyrics, or you weave parts of, you know, extraordinary parts of the lyrics into your conversation. And like, she lived an hour away from me, and we would write each other letters through the mail, through the USPS, every single day. And we would very often decorate the envelopes with lyrics from Little Earthquakes. And so when I hear the song, I remember we were probably like a few months from when we first met at band camp. We were in her very small bed cuddling, and this album is on, and the first two tracks, my heart is racing as I'm hearing the first two tracks, first Crucify and then Girl. And then when those innocent first notes of Silent All These Years comes on, we kiss. It's my first kiss, and this person meant so much to me. And my heart is racing just remembering it. It was such an intense moment. Also, I didn't know how to kiss. And I also want to point out, like, you know how people say, well, they're a bad kisser or they're a really good kisser. And I think in my experiences with kissing, it's about compatibility. Are they a compatible kisser? And this being my first time kissing and being kissed, I didn't know what to do. And she started using tongue, and I didn't know what to do with it. So it not only was it an incredibly tender, important moment hearing that song, it was also kind of embarrassing and silly because I didn't know how to kiss. So lots of feelings in that song. Lots of feelings in that song.
When was the last time you listened to it, or, you know, closely?
Years. I don't even remember. So thanks for putting me back there.
Do you keep up with her at all?
Yeah. In fact, my first tattoo of the bazillion that I have was a ring that she gave me when she came back from visiting South Africa. And that ring is on, that tattoo of that ring is on my thumb, and the only tattoo she has, and it's been since 1994, we've known each other. The only tattoo she has is the same ring on her pinky. But now she is married to an amazing woman, and she has two girls, and we reunited a couple of years ago just to catch up with things. And so, yeah, we are still in touch and still have very much a lot of love for each other. And Tori Amos is Tori always makes me think of her.
You know, I haven't listened to her all through life, but I spent, you know, sort of strangely, I think, a lot of time with that album on a cassette back in, you know, 92 when I was, I guess, 20, 21 years old. I hadn't heard that song in ages, and I remember every beat of it. So
yeah. How did it feel for you?
Oh, you know, for some reason, I can remember being in a car and driving. I can remember a particular place in the car. I couldn't connect it to what I was thinking, but I can remember being at a particular place listening to it.
Mm. That's awesome. Yeah, it's so cinematic, as most of her work is. But I think those first three albums of hers, I think Little Earthquakes, Under the Pink, and Boys for Pele were such a perfect trilogy. Those are the crown jewels, in my opinion, of the Tori Amos collection.
You mentioned having a bunch of tattoos. That's sort of why you're on the show, because when we used your Parkland special back in February, and then when I, you know, Googled you, I saw your picture, and I kind of make decisions on asking people to do the show just based on gut instinct. And I was like, oh, you don't see very many tattooed public radio host, so I'm going to email this person.
Finally, it paid off.
I didn't even like read your bio. I was just like, oh, yeah, she looks cool.
So I do all this to impress you, and really it's just the ink. Got it. That's great.
How many roles did you fill at Connecticut Public Radio before you wound up hosting Audacious?
It's funny that you know to ask that because it's just that's the way it goes. I went from intern to they asked me to record the breaks, you know, to say fresh air is coming up. It's 11 o'clock, partly sunny skies tomorrow. Support for Connecticut Public comes from it's 11:06. And I loved doing that. And I also this is in, you know, 2008, 2009, 2010 at this point. So I had this idea. The reporters would go out and cover a story and they would come back with an audio story. But on the back end of our website, there was a place to put an image. And so the light bulb went off in my head, or the strobe went off in my head. And I realized I could be a photographer for the radio. And so I started begging the reporters to let me know when they were going out on a story, and I would photograph it. And oftentimes people would be like, wait a minute, you're a photographer for the radio? How does that work? And I tried really hard not to sound condescending when I mentioned the internet. But I figured that would be, I actually thought that's what my future career was going to be at that point, was a photographer for public radio. And so I started photographing our guests for our morning show and the news stories. And then Colin McEnroe, he had a show on AM radio for 16 years here in Connecticut. He was sort of the anti Rush Limbaugh drive time type of personality. And he is very much, and I think rightfully so, compared in many ways to Mark Twain. Colin is a truly gifted writer, thinker, philosopher, and he got laid off from his radio station, and he had been listening to Connecticut Public, and he'd heard my voice, and he got in talks with us, and they're going to start a show. And so one day I get a very long email from Colin McEnroe, someone I really didn't know that well because all I listened to is public radio, asking me to be the first and last voice on his new show. And so for 10 years, I was Colin's producer, board operator, and also voiceover actress. We would do these skits. Like, for example, if he was going to do a show about beavers, he would write a little play, and I would be a beaver. And I knew how to use, you know, Adobe Audition and do all that stuff and turn these scripts into little two-minute plays. Some people loved me very much for them, and I got credit for writing them, although I did not. Colin is such a gifted writer that he wrote very well in my voice. And some people really, really hated them and me because they were just so weird. They were so weird. And I'd like to think for the most part they are beloved, but they got a lot of people's attention for sure. And then to keep the story as short as possible, while I loved doing all this work, I was saying other people's words all the time. And I have so many of my own, clearly. And so I started a storytelling show at the Mark Twain House called The Mouth Off, which is sort of like The Moth. And that ran for 8 years till the pandemic. And I also started a monthly advice show at a comedy theater in downtown Hartford called CT Improv. And the advice show was called Asking for a Friend with Kyone Wolfe. And that went 3 years till the pandemic squashed it. But all this in an effort to get more comfortable making my own stuff, because I was pretty convinced that at some point I could get my own stuff on Connecticut Public. And it was thanks to Mark Contreras, our new president and CEO, that he was a big fan of mine and he knew what I was trying to do. I'd already been recording interviews for Audacious, but I didn't have a show yet. And the green light made it go. And we've been going ever since. We're on our fourth year.
Fourth year. Okay. Oh, can you give us a little beaver? Can you like be a beaver?
I don't know to be able to do it without Colin's expertise, but
did you do voices? I assume you did like a beaver voice.
That's what he's looking for.
You would think, right? But isn't it funnier if I speak as a human?
It was just contextual beaver.
Exactly. That's the brilliance of Colin McEnroe.
How do you have a producing team for Audacious? I mean, how do you come up with what you guys are going to talk about? Because you have a really, you know, you guys aren't doing your normal public radio show, I think would be a fair way to put it.
That's a fair way to put it. Yeah, the show and the way it's funny when people ask me how to describe it, the best way to describe it is it's conversations with people who've had uncommon or misunderstood experiences, conditions, or professions. So, for example, one of my favorite shows, I interviewed two clinically diagnosed psychopaths. As an incredibly emotional person, interviewing psychopaths was freaking fascinating. And I also interviewed people who are professional butlers, a woman whose father is a serial killer, Uyghur refugees, pathological liars, but also like professional dominants and submissives in the BDSM community, female truckers, things like that. So it's really all over the map. And to answer your question, I have two producers, an amazing small and powerful team, Jessica Sever and Dee Martinez, who, by the way, applied for the job by sending, she's from Germany. And I just want to put that in there just so you can have it for context, whatever your positive assumptions are about Germans. She was a German auditor and a poet. So then just think about this. An auditor, this is for a producer position. I was thinking, huh, this is bold of her to do this. She's outside the public media world, which is actually something I really wanted in a producer. But she's giving me her auditing resume and a sample of her poetry. And then everything clicked. I realized an auditor is going to be thorough, is going to fact check, is going to research like crazy, will leave no stone unturned, pays attention to details. And a poet, and a good one, and you know poetry's hard. A poet means she can see the romance and the humor and the love and the art. Like, I can't frankly think of a more exciting idea for a producer to be an auditor poet. But it's worked out beautifully. She's incredibly powerful, completely dedicated, thorough, everything I hope she'd be. And then there's Khalil Rahman, who also applied for the position when she did. And we ended up going with her, and it was down to him and her. And when the second producer position opened up like a year later, he applied again. And what was cool about it was he was an intern with us. So I got a lot of love for the interns as a former one myself. And when he applied, he'd actually already been sending me throughout his internship ideas for Audacious. And he wasn't even my intern. And when he didn't get the job, not only was he totally gracious about it, but he kept sending me ideas, even after he didn't get the job, which showed me like a lot about his character, and they were great pitches. So when it came time to get the second producer position filled, it was everybody against him. And I was so glad to get him. So I got the two I really wanted the most. And I'm very lucky to have them, to work with them.
That's so cool. How does other people's poems work?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. So check this out. After my divorce, the divorce was, nobody expects to get divorced, certainly, but mine was particularly shocking. And so when she left, my house felt like a crime scene, and my property just felt very painful to be in, but it was my home. And so I'm trying to figure out, how do I get the energy moved around, for lack of a better, like, how do I get this place to feel different? Like, we got married in our backyard, and so I was thinking about how much I missed having poetry in my life. I just wasn't feeling it because I was in so much pain. It wasn't going to help me. But I got this idea in my head that what if poetry readings, when people come and read their own poems, they're useful and they bring community together. Oftentimes, however, the poetry is is kind of painful or kind of awkward. Or it's just like sometimes when you go to poetry reading, it's just pain, 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 pain. And I was thinking about all the poems that I love that are not only about pain and grief, but are also funny and lighthearted and deep. And so I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I had a party at my house and invited everybody to read a poem written by someone else, a poem they really love. And they can come up and they could tell us why they love the poem, and we could get to know them better. And it would be just such a cool idea. And like, you don't have to have it memorized. You could just read it from the book or your phone or whatever. And then I thought, well, maybe if they have it memorized, first of all, that is incredibly sexy. Second of all, they could win a prize. And back when I had my advice show, Asking for a Friend, the most wise panelist won a loofah. Why a loofah, you're asking yourself right now? Well, it's a cheap prize because you can get them in bulk. It's a ridiculous word, and I love ridiculous words. And you really should be changing your loofah out every month, so that'll incentivize people to come every month. And so I started other people's poems in my backyard, and I ran out of room and kept having it every month. And then the weather got colder, and there's this woman, Lelania Dubay, who runs Hartford Flavor Company, which is this great organic distillery in Hartford. And she's got beautiful facilities. And so she invited me, starting in the winter months, to just change it to her place. And that's where it's been for almost the whole time now. And we've had 21 months of it. And it's just every single time it is magical. Some crazy coincidence happens, or some deep opening happens that brings us all together. Some ridiculousness happens. It is all over the map, and I love it so much.
I actually drove down my drive, down my street yesterday. This is a coincidence. And there was a loofah laying on the street.
Come on.
I was like, wow, that's like a loofah. I didn't stop to confirm that it was a loofah.
Maybe it was one of my loofahs.
Do you have like a box of loofahs in your house, presumably?
I have a basket of loofahs. It's a basket. A basket of loofahs. They belong in baskets. I don't know why. By the way, if you were coming to OPP, Other People's Poems, what would be the poem you'd want to read?
Ickle Me, Pickle Me, Tickle Me Too by Shel Silverstein, however you say it.
I think it's Steen. That's a good choice.
That's just what popped into my head. I don't really know a lot of poetry. I don't read poetry. I've never really been into reading poetry, but I read a lot of Shel Silverstein when I was a kid.
Nice.
Sorry, I'm kind of lost my train of thought there between the loofah and Shel Silverstein.
I know, I'm blowing your mind.
Did you get to see the eclipse? Seems like Hartford was pretty close to that path of totality.
I did. I drove up to Derby, Vermont. A friend of mine, her parents live there, and there were about 30 of us. I knew a handful of people there. It was extraordinary, and I'm not sure how to talk about it, because have you ever been in totality before?
I have been in totality the last two times, but it was completely overcast for me both.
So sorry. I feel like if I hadn't had the experience, and there was not a cloud in the sky, not anywhere near us. It was amazing. And I feel like every time I talk about it, I'm othering the person who's hearing about it, because it's such a the way that it felt now that I have had some time to absorb the experience. I think experiencing totality for 3 minutes or any amount of time is probably as, what word, magical a feeling as I'll feel until I die. Like when I die, the experience of dying will probably eclipse, pun intended, will probably eclipse the feeling of being in totality. But other than that, I cannot imagine anything. It's so hard to talk about. It was truly remarkable. I hope that everybody in their lifetime gets to experience it. But good news, I think when you die, you'll probably experience something even more amazing.
Even under overcast skies, it's still quite remarkable. And where I watched it, I drove out to San Antonio, where my buddy lives, and we went to this little town called Bulverde to an animal rescue farm. And they had a flock of about, you said you had chickens. They had a flock of about like 50 chickens is one of the animals that were there. They had a bunch of, they call them COVID chickens, because they were like chickens that people adopted and then couldn't keep. And they all, wherever they were, when it got to totality and everything got real dark and kind of still, all the chickens ran back and got in the coop together. So that's cool.
That's, you know, so chicken.
That's not like dying, you know. It's not like but it's pretty cool.
that is pretty cool.
Okay, before we get to your third song, let's talk concerts. What was the last concert you went to, like a rock and roll music show, or, you know, something not a Broadway show?
Sure. The last concert I went to was the Indigo Girls down in New Haven, Connecticut. And here's the thing. Listen, Indigo Girls are great. I dabbled in Indigo Girls when I was growing up, especially as a gay kid. But I got to say, first of all, they're great. They sounded awesome. It was so much fun. But there was a big part of me that was going because I was single and I just wanted to see, like, I'm in a room full of my people, you know, and maybe I'll meet somebody. I did not. But it was a fulfilling experience and they sounded great.
Do you have a peak concert experience? Something that sticks out in your brain that you experienced?
Hell yes. Okay. Do you know the band Metric?
I do not.
Okay. They're from Canada. The lead singer is Emily Haynes. I could talk at length about her, but so I love the band Metric, and I had been following them for a while, and I had just started my public radio photography drive. That sounds like a fun drive. I just started taking pictures for public radio, and I thought, well, I could use these Canon 5D Mark IIs to photograph concerts as well. And so I realized that I could write an email to the management of whatever bands I liked and ask if I could photograph the first three songs, which is standard. And they just say yes. They just say yes. So I got a photo pass to photograph Metric. And it was in Boston. And I was so giddy I couldn't speak in the hours leading up to it. And I went with friends and everything. I couldn't function normally. I was so excited to do this. And as a fan, so when the concert begins and I've got my press pass and I'm up against the stage and the lights go out and they come out on stage and they start playing, I'm really torn because I've got the camera up to my face and I'm photographing these amazing human beings, but I'm also singing along like crazy. Like I can't not sing along. And later on, a couple concerts later, I ended up meeting the band and the bass player said, "Oh, I remember you. I've never seen a photographer sing along so much," which I was so glad to hear. It was wonderful. I really love Metric.
I once leveraged my public radio connections to get a press pass as a photographer to go to Florida International University and shoot the Dalai Lama with that camera. I didn't shoot him. I shot.
No, you photographed him.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't sing along with him, but I did that. I was like, they're not going to ask. I'm just going to say I need a press pass as I'm a photographer and I work at WGCU. And it worked.
That worked for me, too, to photograph the Dalai Lama up at Smith College. And I'm curious if you had the same experience. What did it feel like to photograph the Dalai Lama for you?
Well, it was very frantic because they just let us all shuffle out in front of him for like 1 minute. And I'll have to send you a picture. I got this amazing picture. I was a photographer. I don't really do it much anymore, but I had all these professionals around me with these big rigs and flashes and everything. So I did a little trick I do where I kind of drag the shutter. So I was shooting like a quarter second shots and I was letting their flashes do the work, which makes it turn out really like non-traditional.
Oh, that's cool.
I've got a picture of the Dalai Lama looking straight down my lens, right at me. I'm not really like, you know, I don't know. I didn't feel anything mystical or spiritual or anything like that. But as soon as I took that picture, I was like, oh my God, I just got a picture of the Dalai Lama looking into my soul.
Did you print it and frame it anywhere?
It's on my, I've shown it in shows. It's on the wall of my living room.
Oh, I'd love to see it.
I will send it to you.
Thank you.
Okay. Time for your third song. We've gone off the rails a little bit. We're talking about the Dalai Lama. We both got to take pictures of the Dalai Lama, Richard.
And loofahs.
And loofahs, yeah.
You did not start this interview thinking we'd go there, but we really went there.
We go where it goes on this show.
That's right.
Okay, song number three, the Jeff Buckley cover. How do you want to proceed with this one?
Let's talk about it first.
Okay.
I am 22. It's 2002. I'm living with my big brother, Paul. And Paul and I are like 17 months apart. He's the youngest of my three big brothers. I'm close with all my brothers, but he and I are particularly close. We were living together for the first time since childhood. I just moved back to Hartford from Washington, D.C. I'd been in Washington, D.C. during 9/11, which is not a great time to be in that city. And I came back afterwards because it was not working for a lot of reasons. And I felt really lost and depressed and directionless. And one of the things I really love about Paul is that we've always, ever since we were little kids, pondered the meaning of life and this bizarre, beautiful, weird experience being humans. And we just love this sort of the romance of what it means to be human and also the pain. And it was just really cool to have a brother I could talk like that with. And at the time, you know, when I'm 22, I'm a total atheist, which is not the case now, but for a long time it was. And we would talk about meaning and making meaning in a meaningless world, like really deep stuff. It was tough. It was a muddy time, I think, for both of us. And then Paul is a huge fan of Jeff Buckley and is the reason I know anything about Jeff Buckley. And he puts on, in our living room, Satisfied Mind. And it felt like everything clicked into place. So maybe we can play it now.
All right. This is our guest today, Kion Wolf's third and final song. This is Jeff Buckley's cover of Satisfied Mind. This was released in 1998 on the posthumous album Sketches, parentheses, For My Sweetheart the Drunk. This is a recording made in 1992 on WFMU. It's an independent community radio station in New Jersey. This is three song stories. It's biography through music. Does it make you feel the same sort of on some level now as it did then, or what's it make you feel now?
Absolutely. Yeah, it makes me remember him. And also, it warms my heart because I think about that 22-year-old me who, man, her heart was so in the right place. And also, you know, like, she'll always be seeking. I'm always going to be seeking what the answers are and why we're here. But, and the relationship with satisfaction is an interesting one when you think about, like, is it good to be satisfied? Should you be satisfied? But then I think about my time in meditation, and hopefully in the final moments of my life, will I be satisfied? And that feeling is yes. The satisfaction is a thread throughout, and you can still be motivated. You could still be like, I want to do better. You could still pursue and wonder while threading in feelings of utter satisfaction for being a human being still breathing and still pondering and wanting. I think it can all coexist. And that earlier version of me didn't know that that was an option yet. And that song is such a beautiful reminder that ultimately it's your choice, your relationship with satisfaction. And it's a wonderful choice to make, to be satisfied.
When we challenged you with the premise for this show, was that one that came to mind easily?
No, it was actually the hardest one to pick. The first ones, the you can't always get what you want and Silent All These Years were absolutely given, but I actually really struggled with what the third song would be. And it was that, and I actually almost chose another Jeff Buckley song, which was Lover, You Should Have Come Over, which I think everybody who's ever heard that song remembers where they were when they heard it. So yeah, it wasn't a given, but it definitely felt right to choose that one.
What was a fourth song that was close?
Oof. Oh God. My brain just starts spreading out to answer that question. The first place my brain went was, there's a song by Dvorak, string quartet number 12 in F, The American Lento. It's got a bunch. You know how old songs have a bunch of freaking names inside them.
You know, as a host, I hate that because I'm so bad at it.
I know, right? I'll send you a link to it when I first heard it. But this,
I always make the guests say it if they're like a conductor. I'm like, say that long string of things with words and form.
Right. Yeah. But there's this Dvorak song that is the song, I keep bringing up death, but I've always been really interested in death, but it's the song that I hope I hear when I die. It's the most, one of the most beautiful songs I think I've ever heard. And it's, it feels, it feels like a really powerful song, but I also know how it is to produce a radio show. And I wanted something to end on that people could take with them too.
Okay, Kion, you ready for a speed round? We're going to take this thing in for a landing. We're going to throw some questions at you that you might not be ready for, so be ready for anything.
Okay, I'm ready.
Do you have a nickname that has stuck over the course of your life, besides the thing you changed your name to, that you would be willing to share?
Peach. there was a comic strip around the time I was born called Miss Peach, or the character was named Miss Peach. And I have a perfectly shaped skull, according to my mother. Also, thanks for the 4 C-sections she had for each of us. I think lent us those skull shapes. But this comic book character, Miss Peach, apparently had a very round head. And that's why they called me Miss Peach. And my brothers and many people in my family still call me Peach, especially because the name change, you know, that was challenging and for a lot of reasons. And so they call me Kyone, but they call me Miss Peach or just Peach.
Your brother who was on Mad Men, he has a really nice shaped head too.
He does. He does. He'd love to hear that too.
Kyone, you have, I think this might be the first time we've had the same nickname for two people. Because I'll stretch it. Karen Parsons, aka Hillary Banks from
Hillary Fresh from Prince.
Stop. Her nickname is Peaches.
Yeah.
Wow.
So,
well, that's a wonderful little tidbit of information I can tuck in my hat. Thanks.
First time that's ever happened.
If you ever come across her, you can spring it on her.
Peaches. Yeah.
Peaches. Well, what's funny too is so my brother Paul moved to Madrid, Spain 20 something years ago. And he married a wonderful poet named Vanessa Perez Salquillo. And her sister's name is Carmen, but her nickname for her little sister was Melocoton, which is peach. So when my brother met the woman he would marry and they were getting to know each other, and he brings me up and he goes, "Oh, but we call her Peach." Vanessa said, "Oh my God, my sister we call Melocoton, Peach." Isn't that crazy?
Nuts.
If you were a championship wrestler, what music would you use to enter the arena?
Weird Al Yankovic, Polka Face.
Nice.
What would your wrestler name be?
Ooh. French Punion Soup.
That's a winner. Yeah.
That was the name I used when I competed at the Punderdome.
You got him.
Oh, you got a little applause for that one.
Thank you.
Do you do karaoke? And if so, what would you sing?
You know, I don't do karaoke, but I would under the right circumstances. And the first song that flashed in my head was "Can't Live If Living Is Without You."
Oh, okay. Is a hot dog a sandwich?
I feel like because I hesitate to say yes, then it's got to be a no.
What aspect of a bowl of chili is most important when it's competing against other bowls of chili?
Oh, listen, I don't know how long you have for this podcast. I don't know how long you have for this radio show, but
The podcast, we have all the time in the world.
You do.
This part won't make it on the radio.
Oh, so we've got hours. Great.
On and on.
All right, let's go. Let's do this. All right, so a little background. I grew up going to chili cook-offs. My dad competed. My dad grew up in South Philadelphia, so his chili was called South Philly Chili, chili from the real South. Because he clearly wanted to make people mad. So I grew up going to these chili cook-offs. And when it came time for me and all my big brothers, we all make our own chili. But as my recipe has evolved, my chili is great for what's not in it. And that's partially inspired by the cook-offs. Now, things have changed at the International Chili Society. But for the longest time, when you competed in one of their cook-offs, beans were not allowed in competition chili. And it's at this point where people recoil and they go, "What? Chili without beans?" But that's the great thing about chili is that it's a dish that you can kind of make what you want. Although on a side note, I'll say it. There's no such thing as vegan chili.
Correct.
Vegan chili is spicy bean soup. It's not chili. Chili has meat in it. And so my chili, I'll tell everyone who wants to know, because I don't believe in secret ingredients. I want to share the love. Now, this chili is very expensive, which is why I don't make it often. And if you have a big family or a restaurant, it makes sense to add stuff like beans and other things to stretch it because it could be expensive. But when I make it, in the few times that I do, maybe once a year, my chili has no beans, it has no tomato sauce, and it has no ground beef. Now, I know what you're thinking. Well, what the hell is in it? I'll tell you. First, you cook up some bacon. And then you hand cut your meat, your pork, whatever other meats you want to put in it. And you cook these meats through, and then you've got all these meat juices. Then you put the meat in a big pot. In the meat juices that are left over, that's where you put in your onions and garlic, your peppers, your you know, cayenne, not cayenne, and chili powder and all the stuff that you would put in it. And a whole bottle, you simmer it away in the meat juices and add a whole bottle of Chardonnay. I know what you're thinking. Chardonnay and chili, what does this crazy person do? Well, the Chardonnay adds a really nice sweetness to a very hot and spicy chili. After you've cooked all the stuff through, you do use an immersion blender to blend it all together. And then it's a nice dark red. You add it to the meat, cook it down, and it ends up being almost like a dark red brown, like a blood red chili. And not having tomato sauce in it makes it a more meat forward dish, whereas the tomatoes make it more like a spicy tomato soup with meat and spices in it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's the very punctuated version of my Asylum Hill chili. I live in Asylum Hill, which is a neighborhood in Hartford. So Asylum Hill chili is the best chili there is, but you got to come over to get it.
I'm going to be making that.
Go for it. Let me know how it goes. It's just keeping it simple like that. It's delightful. And the best part is the next morning. One other pro tip.
Next day chili is...
Mm-hmm. When you make your chili, if you have friends over who you're clearly trying to impress, before you let everybody know it's time to have it, put some aside for yourself, because it's so good that if you don't do this, they'll eat all of it. And then you won't have any chili for the next morning. And the next morning when you do, of course, you reheat it independently in its own little thing. But then you make cheesy scrambled eggs. And then when you put it in the bowl, there's the cheesy scrambled eggs on one side and the hot, spicy, savory sweet chili on the other side. And then you can decide like what proportion on your spoon you'd like of each. And eventually it's just a mess in your intestines and you're a happy, bloated person.
And just to contextualize this for listeners, Kion is a certified judge with the International Chili Society. Mm-hmm. I didn't just ask this randomly.
And by the way, I will say that it's important for you to know that you may be asking, what does it take to become a judge with the International Chili Society?
Well, the amount of love for chili you clearly have.
True. That's not a prerequisite, but because you could be going to this thing to get girls, you know, as many people do. But it's like $50 and you go to a 3-hour training and you get a pin with your name and your ICS chili number on it. And you get a certificate, which I have framed on my wall. And you can judge at the nationals as a judge. And that I got to do one time in New Hampshire in 2011. Really quick side story. I'm so excited to be a judge for the national chili cook-off, not just the regionals that I'd been doing. I get there really early and I want to get a medal because you get a judge medal. And I get there too early. They say, come back in an hour when we start doing this. I come back and the line of judges is out the door. And by the time I get in to register and confirm I'm there, they've run out of medals. Now I'm a little bummed, but I'm not that bummed because I'm judging at the Worlds. Like, it's not that bad. At the end of the day, they're giving away all the prizes for best chili. And I notice that on the stage, underneath each trophy is a judge medal. There are three of them. And so after they give out the president of the International Chili Society, Carol Hancock, I think at the time, gave away the prizes. I went up to Carol and I said, hi, I was a judge. I'm wondering, is it okay if I snag one of those medals from the podium? If they're just basically props at this point. She takes the medal off of her neck and puts it over my head. So my terrible feelings of not being able to get a medal turned into total elation and honor that the medal I have hanging on my wall right now was worn by the president of the ICS, and she so graciously gave it to me. That's chili.
We can start a podcast about chili.
Oh, we're gonna do it.
This will be
bonus content.
Bonus episode. Yeah,
we're gonna do a little side of the world, taste some chili content.
We make up other podcasts.
Well, while
that
we're at it,
make.
Then would you put your chili on a hot dog, which is not a sandwich?
Yes. Okay. Yes. 1,000 times yes.
All right.
Wait a minute. What do you two think about hot dogs and whether or not they are sandwiches?
I don't really have a a horse in this race. no, I you know, I don't think so. I've never asked this. Nobody's ever asked me, but I think a hot dog is a hot dog, like Dan Navarro said. And a sandwich, I don't know. A sandwich is something that stuff can fall out of all the sides of.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
Wait, no, but then is a sub is a sandwich.
Well, but is a sub a sandwich only because it's advertised as a sandwich?
I think it's a subcategory of sandwich. It's a submarine sandwich because it's shaped like a submarine. Although, in fairness, submarine sandwiches are cut on all sides. So it could
get squished out all sides.
If you were a maniac and you ate a hot dog with a bun that was not connected, that's a sandwich.
That is a sandwich.
No one does that because people would call the police. Like, it'd be a psychopath.
Yeah. Well, that's what Dan Navarro is a guy who he's a voice actor these days for like video games and Family Guy and stuff. But he also wrote We Belong by Linda Ronstadt or whoever. Who sang it? What Linda
Ronstadt?
Oh, my gosh. I always confuse Linda Ronstadt with the woman who sang We Belong. Who is it?
We belong with the night.
Pat
Benatar.
Me, they're kind of the same person. No, but his answer was that his mom used to cut hot dogs down the middle and then lay them on their side and grill them and then put them on bread. And in that case, that would be a hot dog sandwich.
That is a hot dog sandwich. That's true. I think now upon further reflection, I stand by my, it's not a sandwich, because it makes me think about, there was a famous court case that about porn, and it was like, how do you define, you know it when you see it. If you look at a hot dog, you don't think sandwich. And so therefore it's not a sandwich.
I like this definition of,
I had never thought that thought until I said that.
Classification.
That was when I
category,
finally turned inward on that question. That's what I came
Stuff
up
falls
with.
Out of all sides. It's a sandwich.
Yeah.
Which is why a hamburger is a variant of sandwich, but a hot dog is not.
A higher dimension
a
sandwich
burrito is not
would have other questions.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
We got two podcasts. We got two bonus podcasts out of this. Like
we are so in the weeds.
Shows
I love
that don't
it.
Exist.
Before we get back on the normal speed round. So this is this Friday is the last day of our spring membership campaign. Can you give us a little 1 minute pledge pitch, Kion? I bet you got it in there somewhere.
Oh yeah. If you have ever thought after listening to public radio, I never thought of it that way, or maybe I thought I understood this particular topic, and then once I heard this show on public radio or this conversation on public radio, now I think I didn't understand it as much as I thought I did, and you feel humble, and you feel maybe a little even more hungry to learn more. In that case, I think that that's the best possible reason you have to become a member or to renew your membership with public radio, because it feeds you as much as you feed it. And plus, it feels good to be wrong about things sometimes. And so you can learn and grow and get better and better at this thing we call being a human.
I'm going to put that on the air this afternoon. I'm running the board from 4 to 6. So you're gonna get a little WGCU airtime.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Let's return to where we were. If you had to guess, what would you say is the song you've listened to the most times in your life?
Ooh, give me a second. Oh, that's so hard. The song, I can't think of the song that I've listened to the most, but I can say that the song that's been in my head most often is Love Ridden by Fiona Apple. Actually, no, I take that back. It's another Fiona Apple. So let me start over. I can't think of what song I've listened to the most, but the song that's been in my head the most is by Fiona Apple. It's called I Know. And I used to sing it in my head in college when I was feeling especially adrift. And since it felt like a friend that I couldn't feel totally alone, because this friend... The song I Know by Fiona Apple, because this friend was with me. And so now and then when I feel a little adrift or a little lost, I just start singing it in my head. So I think that might be the one.
That's a good answer. What activities or pursuits make you lose track of time the most?
Gardening. My dad I was raised with my dad gardening, and when I got married, the woman I married used to run all the community gardens in Hartford. And so I was not a gardener, but I built the beds and she would fill them. And then after we got divorced, I had a lot of mixed feelings, as you can imagine, about these garden beds that I built. And maybe the gardens won't grow because of all the things that happened and the difficulties I was having. And I was resentful of my gardens because they were hers and all this huge metaphorical stuff. And sure enough, the gardens still grow. And I learned from gardening a lot. One of my favorite phrases is a gardening advice that goes, "It's okay if some things die," which is true for a lot of things. But I love weeding. I love planting. I love inspecting, just being around and getting my hands dirty. I love gardening. I completely lose myself.
You have bees?
I have bees. It's funny. They're Russian bees. And my dog is from Moscow.
That's what I'm curious.
It's the breed. It's the breed. It's the bee breed.
Are they honeybees? They make honey?
You
harvest honey from Russian bees?
Well, I'm about to. I just inherited these hives from a friend's father who was getting rid of all of his worldly possessions to go live on a boat. And so this guy drove two hives up to me. It's probably got 50 or 60 pounds of honey in it right now. And I'm going to learn very quickly how to take care of them. So, yeah, they're pretty great.
I also am a beekeeper.
Oh, good. So I can ask you when I don't know what the hell to do.
Yeah. I can give you some pointers. I mean, I've only gotten a couple harvests out of my hive. But, yeah, it's they're not Russian, I don't think. I mean,
yeah.
They just showed up in my yard.
They don't have an accent.
They don't have an
no.
accent.
By the way, the main concern is, like, keep them watered, keep them fed, and keep them from the Varroa mites, right?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is you need to get in there and peek around and make sure that there aren't, like, hive beetles that are showing up. And, you know, you can test them for Varroa mites, but there's not much you can do. I mean, there's a treatment you can give them. But, you know, there's two ways to look at it. I think that there's, like, the farmer beekeeper, which is hands-on, and then there's, like, the aquarium a beekeeper, which is just kind of like watch it go. I just kind of watch the wheels turn, and so far it's turned out.
Yeah, I think that's how, and I mean, I am pretty new to this. I've had them just a couple months, and my a friend of mine came by to sort of give me some bee 101 stuff, because I learn best hands-on, and there's so much information out there that's kind of overwhelming when it comes to beekeeping. And also the state beekeeping place, because every state has, I guess, some pros, is very far away. So anyway, a friend of mine came over, showed me some stuff, and he also suggested that when you approach the hive, be calm, talk to them, introduce mm-hmm. yourself, mm-hmm. Use sort of a Tai Chi sort of vibe around mm-hmm. them.
Absolutely.
And he also told me about the idea of the tradition of telling the bees. So when something big happens in your life, someone died, someone divorced, someone moved, or whatever, when something big happens in your life, there's one person in the family who's supposed to tell the bees. And I absolutely love that. So I'm introducing myself over and over again right now, so that when I tell them something, they can believe me.
I've never told them stories, but I do go out, you know, every couple of days and say, "Hi, girls, how you doing?"
Love
and
it.
I think, you know, just getting in, you know, going out there, getting in, taking a look around, you know, pulling out a frame or two periodically, as frequently as you can sort of manage, is best, because then they get to know you. They really do. Like, they can be more or less, you know, aggressive based on more than just their genes, I guess you can
yeah.
say.
Yeah, and that's really exciting to think about, because I think because they're so little and there's so many of them, you think, well, how could they possibly? They're insects. Like, why would they know me? But they will. They do.
They will. Song you wish you could hear again for the first time ever.
The feeling I got when Beyonce came out with Lemonade. I didn't care about Beyonce. I knew we had the same birthday, which is pretty cool. But I didn't care about Beyonce. And a friend of mine invited me over to see Lemonade, which is a film of many song videos. And I thought, you know, I'll just stay for a little bit. I'll stay for like one or two songs and then I'll go, because I don't really care about Beyonce. Within seconds of Lemonade beginning, the first notes that come out of her mouth, I knew that I was experiencing something sacred, special, bigger than me, important, unfortunately prophetic for me. It was a true work of art. And I love being corrected. I love being humbled. And it humbled me because I couldn't have in a million years have imagined the masterpiece that was Lemonade. And so that feeling that I got of total humility and awe, I would love to have that experience again.
I've heard similar sort of sentiments on this show before. Maybe it's time for me to actually listen to it.
Yeah, watch it. And just watch it. Well, it does have two. There are two versions. Like when you watch the film, which I think you should, the film offers some things that the audio only version of it doesn't. And the audio only version of it offers things that the movie doesn't. So there are little nuances here and there that you'll get from each.
If you could broadcast a song magically into the head of all humanity in a collective moment, which song would you choose?
It's Only Love That Gets You Through by Sade.
Do you have a favorite band of all time? Is that possible?
I mean, I did mention Metric, but it's funny because when you have a favorite band, I feel like in order to have a favorite band, you got to love all their stuff all the time for the most part throughout their whole discography. And I don't feel that way about Metric. I have just like Tori Amos, those first three albums. With Metric, it's their earliest sort of half of production. So I think Metric is maybe the band I've been the most devoted to in terms of, like, I'm going to listen to everything they do. I also really love Punch Brothers. They've blown my mind on the regular. So it's tough between Metric and Punch Brothers.
What would your 14-year-old self think of who you are today?
She would be ecstatic. I mean, I'm a public radio host. The name of my show is Audacious. I get to be utterly myself and ask people who've been through stuff that I'll never go through, probably, what it's like. Whatever it is about my personality makes it so they open up to me. I have an amazing community here in Hartford. I feel like a big fish in a small pond full of other big fish, and we all get along really well and we all help each other. Everything that I do is successful and met with love. I'm healthy right now. My brain is calibrated well. I never could have imagined this life to be what it is, but it's just dream come true after dream come true after dream come true. And I think my 14-year-old self wouldn't have even been able to imagine such greatness. And so then that makes me wonder, like, what is this 43-year-old version of me not yet able to imagine that's coming at me? We'll find out.
That's a good way to look at it. And cheers to that sentiment. That's awesome.
Thanks.
Okay. It's time for you to recommend three people that you'll share this with who you think we might be able to connect with as well.
Absolutely. So first things first, John Dankosky. I brought him up earlier. John Dankosky was the news director and the creator and host of Where We Live. He's also currently the director of news and audio and occasional host of Science Friday. So
I knew that name. I was like, something's going to happen.
You don't hear Dankosky very often.
Yeah. I actually traded emails with him a couple years ago because they were doing some local science thing.
Anyway, there you go. John, if it weren't for John, you and I would not be having this conversation. It was he who stuck his head into the volunteer room when I was answering phones for the fund drive. And it was just this wonderful voice and big heart that offered me this internship that began this entire experience of being in public radio. So John Dankosky, I owe him, although he would not feel like I owe him anything, I owe him quite a bit. And he's just got such an enormous heart, giant brain, great sense of humor. I love that our lives have overlapped. And so I also know he's a big fan of Rush. So prepare yourself with some, if he doesn't say Rush is a Rush song is in his top three, I don't understand life anymore.
Okay.
But John Dankosky, 100%, just a wonderful person. Next is Dr. Kalila Brown-Dean. She's the host of Disrupted on Connecticut Public. She's also the new executive director of the All Britain Center for the Study of Public Life at Wesleyan University. Kalila just always surprises me. She's she always like she loves NASCAR, and there's and I think anyone who loves NASCAR, because I don't know anything about NASCAR, like I'm always surprised and I always have 1,000 questions. But Kalila is just so multifaceted and brilliant and kind and funny. And I think that I'd love to hear what kind of songs lit her up. She's just an incredibly compelling person. I'd love to learn more about her in this way. And then there's Anthony Fantano. He's the host of The Needle Drop, which was technically... So do you know The Needle Drop? Do you know Anthony Fantano?
Yeah, I know who Anthony Fantano is.
Richard does. I could tell his eyes lit up.
Yeah. So Anthony was an intern at Connecticut Public shortly after me, and that's how we got to know each other. And he started The Needle Drop every Saturday night on Connecticut Public, and he did it for, I believe, 4 years, and then started doing his show as a YouTube channel. And now he has millions of subscribers. Rappers rap about him. He it's his very, very successful living. And he's so smart. He's so he's also able to be, he's got this series where he'll meet people and he'll ask what his worst take was, like how they disagree with him. And so he's got sort of an impish sense of humor and great big brain. And I love knowing that I knew him back in the day. Feels really cool. Also, lately, I don't really listen to music lately because it seems like all the songs are about love, right? Like I'm so angry at you for breaking my heart, or I'm so happy because we're together, or anything in between. And I don't feel any of that right now. I don't have any crushes that are consuming me. I'm not heartbroken anymore. Like, love just isn't really on my radar in that way yet. And so I asked Anthony, could you please send me some songs that you really love that have nothing to do with love? And he sends me all these songs that have nothing to do with love. And it was just such a cool, he was the perfect person to ask to do that. And so I would love to hear in the context of your show, how in the world he would narrow it down to 3. I've got to know.
Well, we would love to have him. We would love to have all 3 of them. So just do what you can.
I will.
That is the end of the road. Do you have any final thoughts you want to leave us with?
Just thank you for this opportunity. This is a beautiful idea for a show, 3 song stories. I think your listeners on WGCU have been lucky to have you do this project. And I hope that it goes on for a really long time, because it does reveal things about people that no other theme necessarily would. And I think you probably knew that right as soon as you came up with the idea for this show, that this is a way in that no other show can really get at. So thank you for making it, and thank you for including me in it, because it gave me the opportunity to look into myself in a way that I never really looked into, and also to include the people around me who maybe remember these songs in a different way. So I am yet again humbled.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot to you both.
For this week's Parting Tune, we're going back 1 year to episode number 267, guest Brian Schreck. Brian's a music therapist at the Norton Cancer Institute in Louisville, Kentucky. His 3rd song story was actually told in 2 parts. He said his older brother, who was quite a bit older than him, was a huge Deadhead. The first half of his song story took him back to August 9th, 1995. His brother had picked him up from band practice, and Brian could immediately tell something was really wrong. His brother told him that Jerry Garcia had died, and he told him that he really regretted never having taken him to a Dead show, because he was never going to have a chance to experience that magic, which, because of their age difference, really stuck with Brian.
We didn't go straight home. We just kind of cruised around the neighborhoods, and he liked to smoke cigarettes, and I just remember the warm summer breeze as it was cooling off as the night kind of came about, and just listening to this song and feeling, trying to empathize with him, but feeling this feeling of grief and mourning that he was very upset that this had happened. So fast forward a few more years. In 2010, he unfortunately passed away. And this is the first song I thought of when my parents were like, what songs should we play at the funeral? And I even used parts of the lyrics in the eulogy that I gave. And it takes me to a sad but also very sweet place of feeling okay that it's okay to be sad, having a space of a song to feel those feelings in. And then as an instrumentalist and as someone that doesn't particularly enjoy singing, I don't often listen to lyrics that closely, but somehow that day listening to this song, it just kind of went into my heart in one of the little pockets and has stayed there. And every time I hear the song, I think about August 9th, 1995, and then I go back to May 8th, 2010. So it brings all these things together in a way that feels real. It can be raw, but it's also a way to connect with him and with my Louisville friends and knowing that I have support. And anytime I want to kind of visit my brother, I can go back to Broke Down Palace.
We make Three Song Stories in the studios of WGCU Public Radio on the campus of Florida Gulf Coast University in Fort Myers, Florida. Richard Chinqui is co-creator and producer. Tara Callaghan is host and online content producer. Our production assistant is Jared Gonzalez. Chris Duff is executive producer. And our theme song was created by Dave Cowan and Stick Martin at Monkey House Studio in St. Pete. Keep listening.